From the bottom of my heart, I want to thank you all for participating at Scala Love Conference. Scala Love wouldn't have been possible without your spirit. Scala Love was conceived as a celebration of our community in the face of uncertain times, and our celebration wouldn't have been complete without you. This was the inaugural Scala Love Conference, and as first-time conference organizers, we're hoping to learn and grow from our roots. To that end, your feedback would be greatly appreciated. We've created a Google form to solicit your ideas. When you have a chance, please find the link in the show notes for this episode. I'm also happy to announce that true Scala Love geeks can get some Scala Love products. Scala logo, kittens, all of this you can find in our shop. The link is in the show notes. And finally, I would like to thank my patrons for supporting me. Scala Love Conference didn't have sponsors, so your help means a lot. Thank you. Enjoy the episode. Hello, everyone. This is Scala Love Show, a podcast about Scala and programming languages. And today, our guest is Richard. Hello, Richard.
Hey, Ollie. How's it going?
Good. How's it going for you?
It's good. It's a beautiful day here in Chicago.
Cool. Let's start with your introduction.
Sure. So, I'm Richard Whaling. I'm a data engineer here in Chicago. I work at M1 Finance. We're a sort of medium-sized fintech startup. I've been writing Scala for about 8 or 9 years, depending on how you count it. And I've been contributing to Scala Native for, I think, three and a half years now, since 2017, actually.
How did you get into Scala?
So I was writing a lot of Python at the time and was really fighting with XML databases in particular. And, you know, I'd heard about, it was like 2008, 2009. So, you know, I'd heard about Twitter's adoption of Scala and their great success. So I got the book on Scala and then it was like, oh my God, it has XML literals. This is amazing. This is exactly what I need. But, you know, I hadn't really ever studied, I'd done C before, but I'd never really studied like a functional statically typed ML style programming language. Honestly, I kind of rebounded off of all the type errors I was getting, but I wrote some interesting code back then. But then later on in grad school, I actually took a standard ML course for a compiler's course, basically. And I think when I revisited Scala after learning standard ML, it just really like snapped for me. That was when I fell in love, so to speak.
I see. Okay, before we moved to discussing your book, because I think it deserves the whole episode. This is a very important topic and not that many resources are out there for people to consume. I want to talk a little bit about your speaking experience, because I think I've seen you at various events, at various conferences before.
Yeah, I think I gave my first Scala Native talk in late 2017 in Strange Loop at St. Louis. My talk was about building a web server or a web application, really, with Scala Native. I think this is the first time anyone had run Scala Native on a web application. So that one was really fun, but also really early. That was Scala Native 0.2.0. We've come a long ways from there.
And Strange Loop is a lot of fun, actually.
Strange Loop is so much fun. You get so many different perspectives. And there's always like amazing off-the-wall things like I once saw this talk where they had hacked a 1980s knitting machine to accept REST requests by hacking TCP/IP to go over an external disk drive connector. And then they'd use it to submit requests to knit mittens or something like that. Mm-hmm. It was really awesome. I love Strange Loop. I hope to get to go back soon. So yeah, that was 2017. And then 2018 and 2019, both years I went to Scala Days. And the 2018 Scala Days talk was really just about doing head-to-head performance comparisons between Scala Native and JVM Scala, and really looking at the differences in performance you get when you have access to sort of manually managed, sort of malloc-free style memory, and how it actually opens up problem domains that aren't even really feasible with fully automatic JVM style memory management. I really like that talk. That was a really good one for me. it ends up being the sort of the first two chapters of the book sort of cover the same material as that talk. In 2019, I gave the Scala Days talk about concurrency in Scala Native. And that's all using the C library libuv, which is the same C library that powers the Node.js runtime. So it provides fully asynchronous operating system wrappers cross-platform for Windows, Mac, and Linux. So it turns out to be a really nice library to work with in Scala Native, because Scala Native has such a fine C interop capability, and because the libuv API at the C level is based on just passing functions around, which turns out to be more fun to do in Scala than it ever was in C. But I'm sure we'll get into the weeds on this a little further into this interview.
A little bit more about your background. So I see you're interested in Scala Native, C, system programming. Where does it come from? How do you get interested?
I mean, that's a good question, and I'm not even sure I could answer it entirely. So for college, I actually didn't go to college for computer science. I went to college for classical linguistics, so ancient Greek and Latin. But, you know, I was a computer-y person, and I took two systems programming electives in college in C. And those really clicked for me conceptually, but I also really struggled with them academically. It was one of those things where I'm really interested in this thing, but it's also really hard, and I'm just putting my whole brain into trying to make sense of it. I'll be honest, like, I think I kind of struggled with sort of the pedagogy that gets used in schools for a lot of this, where like learning C is the sink or swim moment in a lot of computer science curriculums. And like, I was just sort of barely keeping my head above water. But I got a job immediately after college working for a Greek professor. She was a functional linguist, not a computational linguist. But basically she had me working on like computational linguistics chores. And then I just ended up excavating a lot of like 80s C code bases and doing a lot of that like program archaeology when you're digging through like these ancient C programs and trying to write bindings for them to Perl and Python so we could actually use them in modern situations. And then from there, you know, I was working on XML databases, I was working on query languages, and from query languages sort of got into programming language theory. And I somehow got a computer science master's degree along the way also in night school. That whole 5-year period is sort of a blur, to be honest. But yeah, by the end of it, I guess I remained really passionate about very low-level programming, about database guts and query languages in particular. But I think I'd really sort of evolved from a more imperative scripting language approach to really being passionate first about standard ML as my main functional programming language, but I got into Scala pretty promptly after that also.
Okay. And in a pre-show, you mentioned that you want to take a little break and do talks, not about Scala, but about music. And that I was wondering what kind of talks. And also I want to mention that I'm not particularly happy about you abandoning Scala Native.
Okay, I'm definitely not abandoning Scala Native. I'm on the Gitter channel. We have more contributors now and more people being involved. And a lot of people have taken things I wrote in the book, like several people have taken like my libcurl chapter and elaborated on these techniques and developed them further than I did in the book. So it's really exciting seeing the ideas in the book spin out to larger efforts beyond what I could have done myself. So I'm still super involved and sort of coaching and encouraging people around things like that. But open source can be a grind and burnout is a real problem. And I think it's nice to change it up and just sort of get a breath of fresh air. So this is a talk I'm pitching, not even something I've written yet, but there's an open source esoteric programming language for music called Orca, created by this sort of collective called 100 Rabbits.
Haven't heard.
It's really magical. It looks like an old terminal like video game, like Dwarf Fortress or NetHack or something like that, but it makes music. And I just sort of fall in love with stuff like that. I do sort of nerdy computer ambient music stuff. And it seems like it could be a really fun thing to just sort of geek out about for 45 minutes just to change it up.
That's interesting. I think we need talks like that.
You know, and people are doing cool music stuff in Scala Native too, actually. Hannes Roots, he gave a talk at Scala Days last year about doing really cool music stuff in Scala Native. he hasn't even published this, but he showed me a demo where he had Scala Native compiling down to WebAssembly, mm-hmm. and then having the WebAssembly run as like an oscillator module in a web audio processing unit or something like that, which is sort of side project music geek. I really love seeing stuff like that.
That's great. Okay, let's move to the book. So let's start with the definition. What is Scala Native?
Okay, so Scala Native is a plugin for the Scala 2 compiler right now. It's similar to the Scala JS plugin in that normally the Scala compiler outputs JVM bytecode. What the Scala Native plugin does is it replaces the JVM bytecode output and instead produces bytecode for LLVM, the low-level virtual machine, which, despite the name, isn't a virtual machine in the way the JVM is. LLVM is actually more like a compiler backend, and it's the compiler backend that Rust, Clang, the Apple C compiler, and several other newer languages use for low-level machine code generation. Right. So what it does in effect is it allows the Scala compiler to output a compact sort of bare machine binary executable. And as a result of doing this, it's a much smaller binary than the JVM would produce, a runnable image of a Scala Native program in Docker. Something can be 2 or 3 megabytes equivalent to Rust or Go. And then it also uses much, much, much less memory overhead because you don't have to run the JVM runtime, which is, you know, often 100 or 200 megabytes of RAM overhead just to get started. And then in addition, because you don't need to boot this entire runtime up and the executable is small, it also boots up and executes basically instantaneously, more like a C command line tool, like LS or something really simple and powerful. That turns out to be amazing for the ergonomics of a command line tool, whereas like trying to boot up a JVM every time you run a terminal command isn't super helpful always.
Okay, having said that, JVM is there for a reason, right? It's for write once, debug everywhere.
I like that.
Yes.
I mean, it's true. I mean, I like the JVM. I'm not a hater on the JVM. Mm-hmm. The JVM is an amazing piece of engineering. And as someone who's sort of a geek for language and runtime implementations, it's one of the great achievements of our civilization in some sense.
Yes. So why and what for to avoid it?
Yeah, I think there the times to avoid it are when either its memory model gets in the way of what you want to do, or whether it's where its abstraction model gets in the way of what you want to do, or where you generally just want to go much, much lower to the hardware than you would otherwise want to. I would argue that the case of a command line tool fundamentally applies to most of those, actually. Command line tools need to be responsive, and you probably can't pay for the overhead of the JVM. Likewise, if you're running in a situation where you have very limited memory constraints, the JVM's garbage collection might not be what you want. And finally, if you want to do extremely low-level programming, not necessarily at the operating system, but at the application level, something like zero-copy networking, sort of custom database guts, stuff like that, or where you just want to write something more like you would with the C program, I think Scala Native is a slam dunk there too.
Okay, and what is the state of the art there? How many adopters?
That's a good question. So a lot of these are confidential or under non-disclosure agreements, to be fair.
Mm-hmm.
But I have heard very strong indications that Scala Native is used internally at a high-profile video streaming project that mm-hmm. carries many popular branded properties that most people who listen to this would have heard of. I think that's the most I can I can say.
That's
there.
That's enough.
Consider the options for something
yes.
like that. But no, other than that, I actually think Lightbend started using Scala Native really early internally for some of their command line tools and their enterprise and commercial offerings. I think they did some really early work porting things like FastParse and parser combinators to support that actually was another. I don't think there's a ton beyond that. I think there's also been attempts to get things like Scala Format and Scala C itself to run in Scala Native. And mm-hmm. people are also really psyched about getting things like, I don't think SBT itself will ever run on Scala Native because it's so dependent on runtime class loading and stuff like that. But I think getting something like Mill or Fury, I think there is some real interest in getting Scala Native set up over there. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that happened in the last 2 weeks since we last spoke is that we've made a ton of progress getting a lot of Li Haoyi's open source library stack ported over. And I feel like he has a pretty large ecosystem. He's one of the most prolific programmers alive in the Scala community or any other. But I think once we get his HTTP clients ported, I think it's really going to open up a lot of amazing use cases for Scala Native.
Interesting. And I would like to talk more about architecture and LLVM in particular. So you mentioned that languages like Rust also are using them. Can you go into more details? Because I'm not familiar with the technology. I don't know what that is.
So I'm not a compiler engineer, so I want to bracket this, that I'm somewhat outside of my expertise. The real expert on this is Dennis Chabalin, the original author and creator of Scala Native and a recent PhD graduate at EPFL from Martin Odersky's lab. And if you go and read his dissertation, which you can, he will explain how Scala Native works, which is that the Scala Native compiler plugin produces a custom intermediate representation of Scala language. It's a little lower level than Tasty, is something you could compare it to, but it's actually lower level than Tasty.
Yeah, I because thought it about does, Tasty.
Yeah. Maybe we should loop back to that. But what it produces is it produces a representation, roughly, of Scala functions and data structures that is suitable for further optimization and transformation into the LLVM bit code representation, which is even further. LLVM. And again, the name is confusing because it's not a virtual machine like the JVM. It's closer to a portable assembly language.
Mm-hmm.
It's also much, much lower level than C, for example. A lot of people, you know, will describe C as a portable assembly language, but C has, you know, has named variables, for example, whereas at the lowest level, LLVM doesn't. It's just like sort of numbered registers and I think it's a virtual stack machine, basically.
Is that possible to translate Tasty to LLVM?
My understanding of this is that for the Scala 2.13 port of Scala Native, which is still underway, because Scala 2.13 is using Tasty now, right?
Yes.
I believe it is, yes. The idea is that Tasty will be the input to the Scala Native compiler plugin, and then it will output the custom native intermediate representation from there. And then it'll go from the native intermediate representation through the compilation or through the optimization stages and then out to LLVM as before. So Tasty just becomes sort of an additional intermediate stage ahead of the rest of the pipeline, I think. Not an expert on this stuff.
Okay, which means that if Dotty, and I believe that's the case, Dotty going to be compiled down to Tasty, then would it be possible to have this shared Tasty to LLVM part?
Conceptually, I think so. I think in practice, it might be harder than that because the whole thing is packaged as a Scala compiler plugin, and the compiler plugin interface between Scala 2 and Scala 3 is not shared because I think, again, I don't know the guts of the Scala compiler, but my understanding is the Scala 2 compiler is much closer to like classic Scala cake pattern composition. Whereas the Scala 3 compiler is fundamentally functional and really a totally new code base. So even though conceptually, like the inputs and outputs are the same, I think there's a lot of architectural differences just because they're very, very different programs to plug into. That being said, when I've discussed this, I think it will be comparatively easy to get it ported over from one to the other, as you said, because Tasty is there as this common intermediate representation.
Any other insights that you know about Dotty and Scala Native?
I'm not sure this is an insight, but I am really excited about Dotty's metaprogramming capabilities, just because Scala Native is extremely low level, and I love that, but it's not always suitable for day-to-day application programming. However, I think providing state-of-the-art metaprogramming capabilities on top of that gives you the ability to design libraries that can provide like bare metal performance with ergonomic high-level APIs, which gets me really excited. You can do things like, you know, stream fusion and like just you know, automatically convert case classes to structs and arrays and stuff like that, I'd get really excited about. The ideal project would be to like rebuild something like Spark on top of Scala Native, mm-hmm. Scala 3 macros. That would be like a dream project for me. Maybe I'll bring that into Scala days in the year 2025 or something like that.
Okay, let's get back to the architecture. Yeah. I'm wondering about if you have to do manual memory management in Scala Native.
You do not have to. I want to be really clear with this because I'm going to geek out about manual memory management hard because I actually think it's great. You do not have to. Scala Native has a state-of-the-art garbage collector that performs as well or better than the standard JVM garbage collector. Dennis has a whole paper and talk about it. You should go watch it. It's really okay. Cool stuff. For ordinary vanilla Scala objects, your case classes, whatever, those are garbage collected and managed as in a standard Scala program, right? Mm-hmm. And in general, you lose safety guarantees if you were to try to directly manage the memory around that.
Yeah, sure.
Right? The semantics of the Scala language provide certain guarantees of memory safety, and those are not violated or modified in a Scala Native program. Instead, what Scala Native gives you is a family of types in a new namespace package, the Scala Native package. And the most important of those is the pointer type, but you also get a struct type, an array type, and a function pointer type, and one or two others. And the idea is all of the operations to manipulate those types are manually managed by you, the Scala Native programmer, and they map one-to-one onto C constructs, basically, to malloc, to free, to stack allocation, to defining structs and populating their fields, etc.
Okay. Continue.
Yeah, no, so what I would say is what it really offers is that this Scala native.unsafe package is an mm-hmm. embedded Scala DSL with the capabilities of C.
Oh, that's interesting.
That's sort of the big picture. And that regular Scala is separate from that and behaves normally. Mm-hmm. And the really interesting part is where and how you get them to interact and how you provide an idiomatic Scala API around a much lower level, like machine semantics.
That's exactly what I wanted to talk about C interop. So there are a lot of C libraries out there that you could use. And I was wondering if you can use them from Scala code from this unsafe mm-hmm. part.
Yeah, in fact, that's really what it's there for. Maybe to take a step back, there's two good things you can do with the unsafe package. One is you can just manually define plain manual in-memory data structures, structs, arrays of structs, structs of arrays, function pointers and all of the above, et cetera, which is awesome. And the first two chapters of the book cover that. And I probably spent 2 or 3 months writing those two chapters of the book. Covering that material and doing it well is really important as a foundation for everything else. That said, once you've mastered these, they're sort of the fundamental techniques for C programming and systems programming in general. All the really cool stuff opens up when you start using the C libraries. And what's really neat is that you can see it if you open up the book. Defining a binding for a new C library in Scala Native is incredibly lightweight. It's really just sort of a one-line standard function definition where the name of the function and the types line up with your C headers. So it turns out to be really fast to pull together a binding for a well-designed C library. And then you can pretty much use any of them. The ones I cover in the book are, there's libuv itself. I mentioned libuv earlier. It's a sort of concurrent asynchronous runtime that provides networking, file system, operating system functionality in a cross-platform way. It's famously used by the Node.js JavaScript runtime. On top of that, what's really cool is libuv actually has really good patterns for extending its event loop with other C libraries. So we can start to sort of mix in other capabilities on top of that. And the most important one we add directly to the event loop is we add libcurl. And libcurl is the C library that powers the curl command line tool. It's a fabulous and extensive C library. that provides a comprehensive client for HTTP, HTTPS, but also like a list of like 20 or 30 other protocols that you might want to have a client to. Basically any like request-based networking protocol out there. It's really magical. And the idea is that because it plugs into libuv, you actually get concurrency for free as well. So just sort of by taking these two libraries and putting them together, you get a massively scalable concurrent HTTPS client with all of the encryption magic that comes with that, which was kind of exciting for me just because I assumed getting HTTPS working was going to be a total pain in the butt, to be frank. You know, encryption is hard and really hard to do right. And if you do it wrong, you can set yourself up for a lot of vulnerabilities. So being able to not do that ourselves and just rely on a sort of best in the industry C library for that was really cool.
Yeah, and you have the whole chapter about libuv in your book, Streaming with Pipes and Files, right?
Yeah, so there's a whole bunch of different things it can do. I would say libuv really is sort of an operating system as a library, just because it provides interfaces and more or less homogeneous interfaces to network sockets, both client sockets and server sockets, TCP and UDP. It also offers asynchronous file operations. It also offers thread pool operations. It also offers straightforward operating system, you know, list this directory, delete this file level operations. And it offers control over pipes and sub-processes, which is a little more esoteric, but you can use it for building up massively parallel multiprocessor chains. Or you could use it for sort of process management and distributed and parallel computing also. So it's an incredibly powerful library.
That's great. One more topic that I want to touch is comparison with Graal native images.
Yeah, that's a really great one. And people ask me about Graal a lot. Again, like I would say about the JVM, I'm a geek for compiler technology. I've read most of the papers that have come out of the Graal lab, and I love them. They're really cool. They've got a large team of very smart people doing very cool things. The one thing I want to caveat, though, is that the Graal project is a large project, and some parts of it have as much to do with each other as Java and JavaScript. And then in particular, there's the Graal VM, which offers state-of-the-art functional performance on a JVM runtime, which, you know, Twitter is using in production, right? And there's Graal Native Image, which produces compact machine binaries, but those are actually not compatible. You can't have both. Graal VM uses the native image packager uses a lightweight substrate VM, which does not have access to any of the optimization techniques because, again, it's still a JVM. It's still built around just-in-time compilation. And without a runtime code generation mechanism, you can't get to state-of-the-art performance. So for the way Graal works now, I do think you still are trading off between runtime performance versus image size and startup time. The other huge difference between Graal Native Image and Scala Native, though, is that, right, Scala Native is a Scala compiler plugin. Its optimizer understands the Scala language, which is why, even though it's a fully ahead-of-time compiler, it can produce code that performs as well as just-in-time compiled code on JVM. In contrast, the Graal Native Image Packager fundamentally doesn't understand Scala. Fundamentally, it's actually a JVM runtime as a native low-level machine code output, right? So it works at a much lower level and can really only understand the sort of primal JVM bytecode level rather than the Scala semantics that have created that as an output. So there's a very different approach there. And then finally, Graal does have interesting stories around C interoperability. But again, because it's not a Scala package, it can't provide an idiomatic Scala interface to like C level memory management and struct and array handling. That's lower level. It's in a idiomatic Java API, and it doesn't have the nice DSL, which turns out to actually matter a lot for clarity and correctness, in my opinion. But again, all that being said, I'm a huge fan of both Graal VM and Graal Native Image, and especially the Truffle package for interfacing between multiple languages. I just think it's the bee's knees, so to speak.
All right. Tell me more about your book. What chapters does it consist of, and what is there beyond the Hello World?
Yeah. So the first chapter does actually start with a Hello World, But by the end, we actually are solving real world problems. In particular, I focus in the first chapter on parsing large multi-gigabyte text files, mapping them into sort of low-level array and data structures, and then demonstrating how when you're handling more than a few gigabytes of data, low-level memory management really pays off. And you rapidly get into situations where, you know, if you want to scan through a file that's multiple gigabytes, the JVM's overhead of garbage collection really gets in the way. And the semantics of a low-level program let you sort of recycle memory and cut your allocation down to zero. Mm-hmm. And that sounds very technical and obscure, but it also means that there are programs you can write in this idiom that won't complete if you tried to write the same program in a more idiomatic garbage collected fashion. Like maybe my hot take is if you're writing in a garbage collected runtime, nothing really has a sort of linear growth. No algorithm has a sort of linear big O notation growth rate. Because if you try to allocate one of anything for everything you consume, as you eventually fill up your heap, and then garbage collection will start to give you badly, badly superlinear performance. And then if you really want to handle large quantities of small objects efficiently without the overhead, what you really need to do is just barely allocate at all, have a tiny number of data slots, and then just reuse those as you read through whatever your input is.
Yeah, you mentioned that it's a real world problem, and I was wondering what is the example of input that you've chosen?
Yeah, so this is one I used to work on back in my like academic phase. Mm-hmm. There's this Google Books file. So Google, you know, they scanned every book in every library they could get their hands on. And one thing they published from that are these files with word lists with the frequency of every word they could possibly scan listed by year also. So you can get great time series data and tons of really cool like computational linguistics stuff on this. And Google has released all these as these multi-gigabyte sort of tab delimited text files. So there's a lot of really great questions you can ask, like, you know, what year did people start using this word, for example, that can be answered by a really simple program that just goes through and aggregates and keeps a small amount of state as it goes along. So I thought it'd just be really fun to have like a real problem that people could dig into. I really just focused really deep on that problem for the first two chapters.
Okay, what else is in there?
What else? So I do treat the book as like an introductory systems programming book. Mm-hmm. Most systems programming books spend a ton of time on file I/O as sort of the main thing they do. I don't think that's relevant as much anymore, just because 90% of programs I write at work are only doing network I/O. And I bet a lot of people who've started their careers in this industry in the like post-cloud era have never actually had to like directly write out a file at the programmatic level. Like network I/O is what programs do now in a way that it wasn't 20 or 30 years ago when these books were being written. So what I really do is I actually just go straight into like classic low-level POSIX networking APIs, the Berkeley Sockets API, and sort of walk through what the dance of establishing connections looks like. You know, it really is a dance. There's a cycle of three or four system calls that have to be made one after another. But show that because the C interop interface on Scala is so clean, it maps very closely to the C semantics for making these calls. And then once you start getting text in, it's really easy to use very simple text processing techniques to build like a working HTTP client from scratch. Like this is chapter 3 in the book. I haven't even introduced the actual C library interface yet. So instead we just go through with like regular expressions and pull HTTP messages apart. And it works. And like at the end of a 20-page chapter, you have like a sort of rough and ready HTTP client. So that's the third chapter. Chapter 4 is a quick detour into like multi-processing and pipes in particular. I think pipes are really underrated, and I think multi-process programming has a lot of advantages over threads. So I could geek out about that for a while, but I think the really cool thing about that is, you know, perhaps the community has moved on, but I think Scala's heritage has a lot of the actor model in it, right? I mean, actors were a Scala language primitive at one point, and I still use Akka at work every day, for example. And I think the process isolation model that just like POSIX APIs like Fork give us actually maps really closely onto process semantics, mm-hmm. where you can get both total memory isolation, explicit message passing, and supervision hierarchies. I would really love to just like port Akka to like Unix processes and Fork someday, honestly. So I think that'd be really fun.
But isn't it overhead to have multiple processes instead of multiple threads? There are even green threads, right?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So OS threads, processes, and green threads all have different pros and cons, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think all are great for certain applications. That said, I feel like unsynchronized OS threads were probably a bad idea to expose to application programmers. I'm just not sure the memory model works there. So if I'm going to do something at the operating system level, having processes is, I think, easier and safer, frankly. That being said, I don't go into it in the book because this has all happened since the book was finalized, but you can do green threads in Scala Native because we have Xeo support on Scala Native, and it provides a lovely sort of green threading and fiber semantics for any concurrent runtime. And we'll actually get to this. The libuv execution context that we write turns out to be a great fit for Xeo. And the code in the book is what got ported more and more one-to-one into the Xeo implementation for Scala Native.
Oh, that's cool. What other libraries are ported to? You mentioned LeetCoE and Xeo, and what else?
Maybe my favorite one is STDP,
mm-hmm.
Software Mills HTTP library. Just one of my, I think one of the best pieces of Scala software I've ever used. And then again, another one I use at work every day that has great Scala Native support, which I think is awesome. And then lately we've made a lot of progress getting a lot of LeetCoE's open source projects like FastParse and stuff like that, which is really exciting. We've got parser combinators. We've got a few logging libraries. In general, the nice thing is that a Scala library that is mostly pure Scala will port over fine with no problems. It's really only the libraries that do I/O in some ways that you run into the limits of our compatibility with the JVM.
What's, in your opinion, prevents people from having their libraries ported to Scala Native? Because yes, the list that you just said is not small, but it's not like huge either.
Yeah. I mean, this is a bit of a hot take and maybe a bit mm-hmm. of a rant, but hey, I'm on a podcast. That's the point, right?
Yeah.
So I think the biggest holdback is honestly the grind of Scala open source library maintenance and open source burnout and the difficulties the Scala community has in releases and reducing maintainer burden when you have multiple platforms, multiple versions of Scala, and all of them without binary compatibility within minor versions, right?
Yeah.
That's kind of a mess. I think it really does slow down our open source contributors' ability to do anything, because most of these people are people with jobs who are doing this on their Saturdays and Sundays instead of hanging out with their friends or their families, you know? So asking people to spend more time maintaining another platform is... it's a big ask, you know, and I totally understand people who don't have time to take something else on. What's been really great, though, is that as the Scala Native community has grown, we've got people who are sort of skilled up on it, just going in and making PRs, and here's your Scala Native implementation. And that's what I did for Xeo with Lorenzo Gabriele, another really prolific Scala Native contributor. He's been a total rock star in this stuff. So yeah, it's really just about finding people who care enough to do the maintenance, really.
So it's overhead in maintenance, in your opinion?
Mostly. There are a few edge cases. Because Scala Native is an ahead of time compiler, it's missing a fundamental JVM capability. Runtime class loading doesn't work in Scala Native because it doesn't even conceptually make sense, right? And it doesn't make sense in Graal Native Image either. I think Graal Native Image has a few more workarounds for it. But because of that, Scala libraries that rely heavily on runtime class loading behaviors won't work well. SBT probably won't ever work well in Scala Native. Unfortunately, Akka won't work well in Scala Native either. And then the other thing that's probably missing is NETI, actually, the JVM's high performance networking subsystem, which is both a ton of proprietary code, which we can't even look at for IP reasons. But also, from what I understand, Netty's implementation relies on runtime code gen and class loading very, very heavily internally. So even if there were no IP restrictions, they're purely mechanical considerations that would make getting Netty ported over a problem. That being said, I think as the Scala community moves away from relying on like classic legacy JVM APIs like JDBC and bare Netty bindings and towards pure functional programming, I think we're getting to a place where it'll be easier to adopt Scala native. I think of libraries like Rob Norris has a library called Skunk, mm-hmm. which is an implementation of a Postgres database client, but it's not on top of JDBC. Instead, he's using FS2's pure Scala TCP stream implementation, and he's writing a streaming Postgres wire protocol client on top of that. So it's pure Scala end-to-end with like functional streaming as the primitive. And I think getting something like that ported to Scala native is much more imaginable than thinking, oh, we need to find some company to pay 10 people to work for 2 years to get Netty or Akka rebuilt on a totally different platform.
Okay.
That was a bit of a rant, though.
Don't worry. It's interesting. I like this. Okay, so you mentioned several times that you're a nerd into DB stuff, and I can see that there is a chapter number 9 in your book about that.
Yeah, so chapter 9 is something a little different because this is sort of going back to my love of low-level database engines and internals. And it's the chapter where I write a binding to LMDB, which is a key value store C library. And if you look at the performance metrics people take of this, it's just one of the fastest things out there. I think it's like 10 times faster than Redis even or something like that. It's really, really phenomenal. And just showing people really that with a sort of really well-founded and robust backend C library, you can write good, persistent, durable data storing code in your own programs, I think is sort of ideologically important to me. I feel like we all settled into this sort of three-tier application architecture where you have your front-end code and you have your application code and then you have a database, which is the only thing that stores anything. And I'm a really big fan of programs that actually have state and durability and can store stuff themselves. I think there's huge advantages over using an off-the-shelf database for a lot of this stuff. And then I feel like a sort of a full-featured C library that gives you a lot of the robustness of that for free, but then lets you sort of build your own design patterns around that and your own APIs is really, really cool. So I'm really excited to see what people do with that with Scala Native. And we actually just had a contributor, David Buisi, who actually is working on a really nice high-level API around LMDB. So it really makes me happy when I see people in the Scala Native community take something, you know, I wrote 10 or 15 pages on the book, but didn't really elaborate further on, and take that and make it into a real library for other people to use. That really makes me happy.
That's great. To finish up our conversation, I want to ask you about the Scala Native maintenance status.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And we were sort of frozen for a few months towards the end of last year because Dennis, the author of Scala Native and the key contributor, he finished his PhD, he graduated, he got a new job, and he's still working out what his role in the community is going forward. But we did have a few months where PRs weren't getting merged, for example, which is scary for an open source project and especially for a Scala compiler plugin, because we've lost others in the past like this. The really, really exciting news that we've had in the last couple of weeks has been that the Scala Center is committed to officially maintaining Scala Native going forward, and that Sebastian Doran himself is actually shipping code and merging PRs and reviewing things, and that they've hired an engineer, Ergis Dona, to work on Scala Native particularly, and he's doing a ton of amazing quality of life things.
Scala JS 1.0 was just released.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, massive congratulations to Sebastian. That's a huge milestone. It further makes me excited that he's sort of stepping in to get Scala Native all the way to the finish line too. I hope Scala Native can get to 1.0.0 in a year too.
Yeah.
That would be really, really exciting to see happen. So yeah, I'm really, really psyched to see the Scala Center and the EPFL really giving their full-bodied support here. And they've got a really great team working on it.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear this too.
Cool.
What is love in your opinion, Richard?
That's deep. Yeah, I'm not a philosopher. I'm not a compiler engineer, and I'm not a philosopher of love. So I'm not sure I'm qualified to answer this. I'd say I know what obsession is. I know what habit. I know what attachment is. But I don't think any of those things are love. I'll say this. I'm not going to talk about what love is in an interpersonal sense, what it means to love another person. But I'm a geek, which means, you know, I love Scala Native. I love music. I love video games. We use the word love for that, but I think that's different. I don't think it's the way you love a person. I don't think there's sacrifice in the same sense. So I think in that sense, love is, it's not just obsession. When you're talking about love of a thing, it's when you see that thing and you feel that thing has value and that thing is worthy of putting some part of yourself into it. Maybe that's my best attempt. It's like, I saw Scala Native. It's like, I like this. I want to get on board. And I had a PR into it like a week later. Like that's sort of what falling in love with a technical thing is for me.
Okay. On this note, this was Scala Native Love episode. Thank you, Richard, for coming.
Yeah, thank you so much, Ollie. This is really fun.
Yeah, thank you for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, y'all.